Good morning, everybody. This is the IT Showcase panel, Microsoft IT, how Microsoft IT manages SAP risk and downtime. And what we want to cover today is some of the processes, some of the procedures, and how we're doing this. After that, we'll have an open panel discussion. And please, this is the first time that we've been doing this, so give us your feedback at the end of the session. Let us know if you want to see more of these Microsoft IT Showcase panels. My name is Hans Reuter. I'm a Principal Service Engineering Manager. My team operates service engineers and architects, SAP services and systems at Microsoft IT. And to my left, we have Elke Bregler. She's a Principal Service Engineer and Architect. She's responsible for systems and services integration primarily. To her left, we have Aaron Stern. Aaron Stern is a Senior Service Engineer and Architect. Primarily focusing on platforms for SAP systems and services, things like virtualization and Azure. And then we have Eric Holling all the way to the left. He is a principal service engineer and architect, primarily focused, again, on platforms, things like Azure, SQL, et cetera. And then from the product group, we have joining Jürgen Thomas. He's responsible for Azure primarily. His team works specifically for SAP. Our agenda is primarily an introduction of the SAP systems that we have at Microsoft, some of the processes that we're using for high availability configurations to address downtime concerns, and primarily focusing on avoiding planned downtime. To give you an idea about what we're doing at Microsoft IT, what you see on this slide are all the main systems that we have at Microsoft IT. The big box to the left, that's our oldest system. It's been live since 1996. And this is our typical main ERP system. All the financials, all of HR, a lot of supply chain processes running in here. We do payroll for North America, for example, for the US. And this is our largest system with 100,000 plus users. We also have some other systems, global trade services for denied party screening. We have supply chain management or APO, e-recruiting, master data governance. We have CI and CC, we have BI, and multiple solution manager systems. So overall, it's a very big landscape, and there's a lot of critical business processes running on these systems, which is why we're so interested in minimizing planned downtime. From a business impact prioritization, HA or high availability requirements vary from system to system. It really depends on the business impact that the maintenance or planned downtime of the system would cause. You know, not all systems are treated the same way. Some of them are more important than others. So it all depends on how much effort, how much money you want to invest into those systems. And of course, systems grow, systems change over time, and that would be a good practice to periodically reevaluate your high availability requirements for each of the systems that you have. Most of the systems that we have are either high availability on the server level or on the SAN level, or also on the SAP configuration level. And then some of them, of course, are also having an additional disaster recovery capability. So if we have to have systems that are, super critical, we have to have a disaster recovery capability in place where we can, in case of an emergency, fail over and have a backup system there. This is a architecture of our current main ERP production system. What this is the system that you saw in the big box earlier. And this is a system that has about 100,000 plus users. And what you see here is a very redundant landscape with a lot of failover or redundant capability. So you have the typical three components. You have on your right your application servers, and there we're using things like SAP logon groups and batch groups and RFC groups to make sure that we have redundancy built in. You have in your upper left corner the central services instance that is clustered, again, for redundancy, so that in case of a maintenance or if you need to do anything to one of the nodes, you also have your second node available. And then on the bottom piece, you have your SAP databases. We use SQL Server Always On. That's basically, we have more detail about that later, but basically we have two databases, a primary and then a synchronous merge to the secondary. Again, we can fail back and forth in case of a planned maintenance activity. So to the end user, the system will appear up and available even though we're maintaining or taking down individual components or individual servers. What we're doing in the future is that all these physical servers that you saw there in the previous slide are now going to be virtual servers. So at Microsoft, just like anywhere else, we're pushing more and more services into the cloud and to virtualization. So what we're doing here is we're running the system on a private cloud where the application servers and the CI will be virtualized, and only the database servers are so big that they will remain, at least in the near future, on physical hardware, and we'll, of course, constantly reevaluate that. Having dual databases allows us a lot of flexibility with maintenance, with planned failovers. We basically are able to run that whole system, you know, in a end user physical uptime, but on the back end, we are still able to maintain the individual databases, and we'll have more details about that further down. From a regional redundancy point of view, of course, we have disaster recovery in place. Disaster recovery for us means in case of a disaster, we cannot afford more than 2 minutes worth of data loss, and we need to be back up and running within 24 to 72 hours. In reality, because we use SQL Always On, we have a tertiary that we send our data to, and in case of a real disaster, we would potentially lose a few seconds worth of data, but we would quickly fail over to our test system, which is basically our disaster recovery standby system. And we'll bring that up. We test that every year. And in our annual DR test, we typically do that within 4 hours. And of course, in the future, we'll be leveraging Azure capabilities in this area as well. Why are we using our test system? Primarily because it's already there, so we're not incurring an additional cost. And it's always up and running, so we know it's up and available. What we're doing with our configurations is we're focusing on minimizing planned downtime. And this is on the server level, on the operating system level, where we have a few rules in place. And the goal is to really have the same hardware and the same application level configuration to make sure that it's consistent across the whole landscape. We have a spare server in place. So in case of us having to take out an existing application server and we do need extra capacity, we can bring that spare server in. If we do maintenance during very slow periods, typically we don't have to do that. But that spare server has pre-configured production instances on it, so it's very easy to bring that in and have any kind of capacity concerns addressed by that. For the end user, of course, it's invisible because there's still many application servers that they can log onto. And of course, all of this work is happening while the system is up. We don't take our system down. We do all this maintenance while the end users use that service and while that service is available around the world. So as you know, with any kind of global company, there's never really a good time to take downtime. Right? Business is 24/7. So this process allows us to do that. The work, whether it's maintenance or any kind of patching or anything that's going on, is always done on the inactive servers or on the passive nodes of the clusters or on servers that have been removed from the logon groups. And the system stays up and running. And then once the work on these servers is done, we bring them back into the group. Once the work on the passive node is done, we can switch back to that node, make it active again. And for the end user, that's invisible. The system was up and running while we did that maintenance. And there really is only a very brief downtime as you switch from this passive node to the active node. It's typically in the amount of seconds or less than a few minutes. So all that maintenance work that you did previously, that was while you were running on the redundant nodes. You see the SAP system is connected to the primary one. We continue the work until it's done on the secondary, and then we switch over from the primary to the secondary. Typically it takes a few seconds as the system fails over, reconnects to the former secondary, which now becomes the new primary. And then on the third step, you see the former secondary is now the new primary, and we're now doing the maintenance on the secondary. So whatever work, which potentially might take, even hours, for the end user, the only visible downtime is that brief failover for a few seconds. And that's how we overall get to great availability in our SAP systems. With that, I want to open it up to a discussion. We have a panel of experts here. So please submit us your questions, and we'll address them as best as we can. And we also received quite a few questions in email beforehand, so we'll go through those as well. Thanks. All right, and we have our first question already. Since we mentioned downtimes and high availability, what is our raw or planned or unplanned availability for our SAP systems? Okay, do you want to take that?
Yep, I can. So the process that Hans was talking about, really, the availability is measured on the service level, so it's not on a single server level. And for this service level, raw availability is about 99.98%. That is beneath the SAP application layer. So we still have longer downtimes on the SAP application layer when we have to do support packages, but everything outside of SAP, let it be data server moves, let it be operating system upgrades, let it be security patches, all these other work, that all comes in and actually ends up with 99.98% of raw availability. So very, very high availability of the environment overall.
So when you say raw, that's planned, unplanned, all rolled into
everything together in one. Yes.
So 99.998, that's a few minutes worth of downtime visible from the end user perspective.
Correct.
Per year. Okay, we have another question coming in there. How long have we been doing this? So, when did we implement these processes? I'm going to go to Malcolm.
We started actually in 2006 with implementing these processes the first time. That was after we had our first version of database mirroring in the system. And when we used the database mirroring capabilities, we suddenly started to see there's way more potential in there than just going and using it for securing against unplanned downtime. So we started with the first thing. We noticed how much of a big benefit that was for our installation. And then from there on, we further deployed the kind of downtime minimization processes out through our landscape. And for some time, it became like a kind of competition where everybody was trying to actually come up with a better process where we also could use that as well. And so over the years, we further developed it. It's never a static process because there's always new technologies that are coming in that can add benefit to our downtime minimization processes. So it's something that we keep on looking over all the time. I really also want to mention that it's not just something that is going to work with SAP. It's also applicable to many, many other applications that have kind of a similar high availability setup.
There is a follow-up question. Are we using similar process when we move data centers or when we have a whole end-to-end hardware migration? Aaron, if you want to.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about that, the process is we do leverage the same process that we talked about for high availability, for planned disaster recovery, when we do data center moves. The concepts are basically applicable for any type of maintenance activity.
Is it fair to say when we do a data center move, we exercise this kind of like a disaster recovery failover, but we just never fail back?
Yeah, so that's a really good way of thinking about it. I mean, that's how we treat it. A data center move to us is a disaster recovery exercise, and the interesting thing is that since we practice our disaster recovery exercise annually, we actually are, when we have to do a data center move, we already have that kind of built-in knowledge and training.
Okay, great. And just as information, we're in the middle of a whole bunch of data center moves. We've done four so far, I think, this year.
Yeah, roughly.
Four. Yeah, so
four systems.
And there's some more coming. Okay, I see some more questions online. So any drawbacks to these processes, any negative things, any side effects that we're seeing with these processes? Well, who wants to take that question?
I can take it. Actually, we really don't see negative impacts because what it is, originally we used to have to do this work during the normal standard downtime window, which in our case for the system is Saturday nights, 11 to 1 a.m. So whatever we did, we always had to do it within this 2 hours time window. And it worked 15 years back, but in the meantime, the system has become bigger. We got more systems. Now the work window of 2 hours is just not enough anymore for all the work that has to be done. Plus certain works we have to get done by our teams. Those teams might have an SLA for the work to be executed of a 4 hours window. Once again, doesn't fit into our downtime window. And so when we implemented these processes, we were able to take the real downtime of the server, of the work, out of our standard downtime window and move that into normal business hours. So the work now is done, for instance, Tuesday mornings, starting at 9 a.m., and if it takes till noon, it just takes till noon, but the system is up and running, so we don't have a negative impact. So there really is way more positive impact, so that A, the quality of the work is better that we get, because it's not done during the off hours where people don't necessarily want to really be in the office, it's done during the normal office hours. If something goes bad, problems are fixed quicker because people have the back office people available other than Saturday nights when there's nobody around and it just takes way longer to get hold of people. And so even that work that's done while the system is running on those servers, as mentioned, it's done quicker and it's done with a higher quality.
Yeah.
And then the real downtime impact of the system now is only a standard change. A standard change by switching our cluster nodes or a standard change by switching our database servers. And that's it.
Okay. Thanks, Elga. There's a follow-up question to the SQL always-on configuration that we have. What can you do if you don't have SQL always-on? Are there any other kind of mechanisms that you can use to have a similar high availability configuration or get similar results? I'm going to give that to our SQL guy, Aaron.
Yeah, you can use log shipping to essentially back up, copy, and restore your logs to remote hosts for added physical redundancy and a copy of your database that you could either use for maintenance activities or for DR. So yeah, there are some other alternatives. And you could use failover clustering if you're talking about the compute level.
Okay. We also have a new question online that's related to tools. What are we doing to either monitor system health or monitor performance in general of the SAP environment? And I would assume that applies also while we're doing this maintenance. So any kind of special tools monitor our health or performance of the system? I'm going to give that to Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, so I think we have a lot of various tools. And when we talk about a couple of primary tools that we use is SCOM, going for kind of infrastructure, OS level monitoring in place. We can use it to pull up get performance counters to understand if the server's gone offline unexpectedly. Important thing I should mention while thinking about it is also, since you want to make sure that you put things in maintenance mode when you're doing planned activities, so that way you don't get alert storms from your operations team saying what's going on. But it gives you a really good kind of sense of what's happening in your system. We also use that to actually know what the performance of our system before we make a change and also after we make a change. So it's really good, not only just for monitoring, but just as a kind of quality health check. And then from SAP itself, typically what we're using is a solution manager for monitoring SAP application layers itself. When you talk about virtualization and for exposing, again, performance counters to some of that information, There's the VM monitoring from the host perspective.
VM monitoring for the host.
The performance counter, so.
The SAP.
Guest host monitoring.
Yeah, guest host monitoring.
Yeah.
So we use guest host monitoring for the virtualization layer. And then in Azure, there's the Azure extension.
VM extension. There's a special VM extension that we developed for SAP that is getting installed with a PowerShell script, and that enables you to get some base performance counters off the host, of the host health and storage account health. So there's a lot of questions coming, so please keep going. We love the questions. There's a specific Azure question, since you just started about that, Jürgen. Any of these processes, how do they change, or are they also applicable if you're running completely end-to-end on Azure? Yeah.
So, absolutely. These processes are, in terms of high availability, for sure applicable for running a production system or a SAP system that should be highly available in Azure. Always on works perfectly in Azure as well. Customers that need this degree of high availability will certainly use it in Azure already in conjunction with SAP software. The same can be said for protecting the SAP ISCS, SCS central instance as well. That works the same way as it works on-premise as well. So yes, on these processes, the technologies that we're using here, as well as some of those processes, are applicable as well in Azure. Even moving into Azure, you can use SQL Server Always On to move basically that database into Azure, having the primary on-premise and the secondary in Azure. That is something that we also support, that is also able to be set up, that you also can set up in even moving into Azure and then continue there with an always-on configuration.
Okay. And another Azure-related question, Jürgen, so I'm going to stick with you. We do, as we showed in the previous slide, we do our disaster recovery primarily with on-prem physicals and on-prem virtualization at this point. What are some of the options where you can do this completely in Azure?
Oh yeah, that's we have two main scenarios that we are seeing with SAP workload in Azure right now. The one is that customers are moving parts of the SAP landscape into Azure to run it out of Azure. But one of the big other scenario, the second big other scenario is that customers are using Azure solely as a disaster recovery summit. Possible without a problem. We have, on the database level, we usually recommend to use database method in needs, always on being one of them. on the application level of SAP, of the SAP applications, we recommend to use Azure Site Recovery Services. That is basically, if you're running Hyper-V on-premise, that's like asynchronous Hyper-V replication. We also have functionality in Azure Site Recovery that allows you to replicate from bare metal into Azure VMs, or even from VMware-hosted virtual machines into Azure VMs. There's also a documentation out for that in the Azure documentation sections section in the specific SAP section. You have a document that describes such a scenario and how to set up such a scenario.
Okay. Thank you, Jürgen. We have another question that is asking about when do we do these types of changes? Are these typically done, you know, middle of the day? Are they done during low periods? Any restrictions? Aaron, what do you
think? We basically can do them anytime. The one thing we will keep in mind is critical periods and stuff, that you may have change phases and things like that where you're not, you may, business reasons, decide not to. The nice thing about this, in this process, is that during the middle of the day, you can go and do maintenance on your systems, and then just occur a short time, short downtime during your maintenance windows to fail over from your active, to your active node, and then continue your maintenance.
Okay, so hours of maintenance work if needed,
yep,
during the day or whenever, and then, you know, the few seconds of downtime, failover time,
yep,
during the maintenance windows.
Right. Yeah, and then even, and that's actually how it occurs for data center moves. And, you know, even when we're doing about that, you set that stuff up, and the initial part getting over there, it can be pretty quick, relatively compared to what it would take if you were going to do it all from scratch.
Right. Okay, great. Let's see, lots of questions. Please keep them coming. Here's one specifically around, if you don't have Windows clustering, what are some other options that you can do? Eric?
For the database layer, I mean, we mentioned earlier that you could use log shipping. In that case, you could do the same kind of rolling maintenance. It's just more manual as opposed to, you know, automated failover once you trigger it. For the application layer, I mean, so the central instance host, without clustering, you kind of have a problem there because that is a single point of failure. Application servers, we don't necessarily need to be clustering there because we have physical redundancy for our login groups.
Okay, so recommendation would be try to have clustering, but at least for the database server, there are some more manually labor-intensive workarounds.
There are,
in case, you know, you want to use log shipping. Okay, great. Hey, another question that we have is, how do you do either OS or SQL upgrades with this kind of process? So all the maintenance activities that we've talked so far have really been focusing around kind of server maintenance. How do we do OS upgrades or SQL upgrades and still minimize the downtime on those? Eric, why don't you do a SQL upgrade and then we can do the OS upgrade to somebody else?
Sure, from the SQL server standpoint, if you take the always on scenario as an example, you can upgrade the secondary nodes, and then once you approach your downtime or hit your downtime, you can do the quick failover to the upgraded node. So this is what we call a rolling maintenance methodology. And if it's a real version upgrade, you may have a short period of time where the database schema gets upgraded as part of the failover recovery process on the upgraded host, and then you can complete your upgrades on the former primary.
Yeah. If I can add something there, so if you really have three database servers like we have, like the DR site and two local high availability nodes, it actually means we do this rolling upgrade for SQL Server, and we always have two workable database servers at any given time while we do the upgrades. So if something would really go bad during an upgrade, which knock on wood, we haven't had, and we've done many upgrades, we always would have two workable solutions, and then we could just, worst case, we to a complete installation of the SQL Server on that other node and do a restore of the backup, bring it back in sync, and then proceed with the work. And that really is one of the other nice parts of the downtime minimized way to do these kind of changes, because as long as you don't plan the work to be done step after step after step, but you actually give yourself some time in between, even if something unforeseen is happening, you still have enough time to fix it, and you're not going to occur more downtime in production. The worst case that might happen is that you might have to delay the failover time from one weekend to another weekend, but if you plan it with a lead time before it already, you even can overcome unexpected issues without having to even reschedule that downtime.
I think the most important thing here to emphasizes in always on, I can run, let's take the actual situation that we have here with SQL Server 2016 appearing on the horizon. You can run the primary database replica in the state of SQL Server 2014 and have the secondary already sitting on SQL Server 2016. And still be able to replicate the data into the SQL Server 2016 replica without a problem. So you're never losing really your high availability. The only thing might be that in the event of an unexpected failure, you might be faster on the new database release than you want it to be, but it basically works to have different main releases of SQL Server within this always-on configuration. That's a very important point.
Yeah. And we've done this process, Harry, since 2008 or even before that.
SQL 7.
Yeah. So it really, really works very well for us.
Okay. Great. OS upgrades, Aaron, do you want to cover those?
I mean, OS upgrade perspective, when you're talking about like your application servers, you typically just go and drain them out and then you perform the OS upgrade get a new server kind of migrate your executables onto the new server. Couple of different options you can go do, but basically is we just kind of take out a piece of the landscape and pop in the new upgraded OS. For clustering, currently today, the easiest thing to do is at the moment would be to develop set up a new cluster, use your high availability disaster recovery type of processes that you've already designed, and just fail over effectively from the current older version to the newer version of your cluster and OS.
Yeah, and you can do the same also without having to add new hardware. What we typically do is we just eject one cluster node out, then build that to the new cluster version. So we have a single node cluster on each one of the old version, one of the new version, and then the downtime is to take the cluster name and IP addresses over to the new cluster. And we run on the new cluster, and then we rebuild the old node and import that into the cluster after it was upgraded.
So one thing we should probably mention that's also kind of important for all the stuff is the fact that alias names.
Yes.
The alias names is what we have set up is basically we have this virtual name sitting on top of SAP, even on our app servers. So that's really a critical foundational element that you need to have in place, and that's what makes it really easy for you to move from one hardware or OS change to another, or sorry, one server to another server, and you just move basically that name from the one server to the other server, and basically invisible to your end users.
Yeah, and the benefit really is that you don't have to reconfigure your application to get the new name into your logon groups, into your web server groups, and all of that. You just really easily take the name of this one server, the server alias name, and move it to the other and start your SAP instance, and off you go.
Okay, great. So both, what I heard you guys say, both SQL and OS upgrades, very easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the primary principle is you do all that work while the system is still up and running.
Yep.
You do it on one of the inactive nodes, and then only during the actual failover will the user, again, experience any kind of downtime. And you're going to think very important point. You said, you know, even a newer SQL version on your secondary or tertiary that's supported, you will still be able to mirror data, replicate data over there while you know, running on different versions, right? So we have a follow-up question coming, and the follow-up question is really around, if you have all these great maintenance capabilities in place, do you really need to do any kind of backups? Let's give that to, I'm going to give that to Eric.
Yes, always have backups and always prove that they work via restore. If you haven't proven your backup is restorable, then you may as well not have one.
I think, I mean, and it's a critical to do those, to do the backups in this, to test it, because, for example, in, all this high availability doesn't necessarily save you for someone deleting data accidentally.
Correct.
I mean, the backups, backups itself, also the backup process and the restore process, you want to have in place because of exactly the case of somebody deleting data, or not only somebody, even programmatic errors that can cause you to lose data. And you need to be eventually able to set back the database to an exact point in time, and that is only possible with backup, with a complete backup and restore. So no doubt.
And to be clear, you know, in such a scenario, we would pick another server to restore to.
Straighten
the data out and rebuild it as needed.
Yes, exactly.
So we don't lose data.
Exactly.
Which we've actually had to do in the past, because someone does something that they, you know, aren't supposed to, and you'll say, oh, what was the state of something beforehand? So yeah, definitely backups, I think, are super critical.
Yeah. Okay, so. And also I would emphasize, not only have it, doing the backup, the more important point as well is to be aware of the procedure, how to restore backup or make sure that the backup is not restorable. Since I'm working as well, since I'm also the last line of support for our SAP centric SQL Server support engineers that we have based with SAP. Every year we have cases where customers are in dire need to get backups restored and figures out that the backup media is corrupted or these kinds of things. Literally, this year we had a customer that started after 6 weeks in production, needed a backup, had never done a backup, or only had one from 6 weeks back that was restorable. I mean, these are horrible situations. You want to avoid those.
Yeah. So I heard an emphatic yes, you have backups in place. And I think that's a really good point. What we're talking about here is to get high availability, to have redundancy built in the system so that your planned and unplanned downtimes are mitigated. This is not safeguarding against data loss or any kind of human or machine errors that will corrupt data. So the goal is really to treat backups and things like that separately from high availability and redundant configurations. Good point. We do have a follow-up question, and it's really about, can you walk us through a scenario, can you walk us through in detail how, for example, you would exchange a server, whether it's an app server or maybe a database server. Can you walk us through the step-by-step how that's really being done? Aaron, you want to do that?
Yeah. Why don't you start with one?
So step-by-step, I guess.
Exchanging an application server, how would that really
happen? So from exchanging an application server, what you'll want to do is, from an SAP perspective, you're going to want to drain that out, which means you're going to want things like your logon groups, your batch server groups,
RFC
groups, just basically all your standard high availability stuff you have within SAP. You basically need to go and take that server out. If you go and if you have a spare server, then you'll want to replace that with a spare server so you don't lose capacity. Once that system is completely drained, you then can do whatever maintenance activity you're looking for, verify that what you've done looks good, then basically reverse the process, put it back in, put it back in availability groups, put in the RFC groups, the batch groups, so on and so forth, take out your spare, and then just do that and repeat that one server at a time or however much capacity you can take away and still meet your business SLAs.
Yeah, and in the meantime, do the work that you need to do, whether it's now a security patch, so you apply the patch to the server that you just took out, you to reboot the patch, you move the server within the data center if that's a requirement, you upgrade the server to a newer OS, whatever it is that you need to do. We've also in the past, we had to exchange memory on a server, for instance, so we use that process to do that. So whatever kind of work you need to do, or move from an old server to a new server. So your old server is end of life, you need to go to the new one, you use this process to actually go from this server to that and use the alias name and move it over to the new server where you already have your stuff installed. So it's really, it's always the same overall principles. The detailed steps might vary depending on what it is, but it's always you work on the node that's currently not active in production. You do the work during normal standard office hours while the system is up and running, and then during the real downtime window that you have, you do that one work that really will cause an impact to the system. Only needed for the single point of failure, which is the database and the SAP central instance. The application service you actually can move normally during the week, because the expectation always is you have enough servers in there so that if you take one server down, you don't completely reduce the capacity or a specific functionality, so it's not working at all. There's still another server left over that can do the same, and then so you're fine to do that even during the week.
Plus, we have that spare server that we can throw in case we really need extra capacity needed.
We never have that.
I think the principles here are really, phrasing more abstract the server name, or the physical server, as well as the instance name from workload, have no workload, no interface connecting against the instance name, or even use the physical server name. So you use all the SAP method and means with the logon group, batch server group, RSC server group, automate spool server, what have you, in order to really be able to take out dynamically an instance and brain as well. You should use the virtual server names that are known to SAP, not the physical server name that SAP instances are referencing. It's a virtual server name that SAP instances are referencing. With that, you move the SAP instance pretty easy around. So that's a very important point. And in those circumstances, there should be any applications, any users connecting against IP addresses, physical server names, or hardcore instance names, except eventually the administrators, the basis team, but not the finance user that you have connecting against one specific instance.
Okay, we have a question where people are asking, are there any differences between physically based environments, on-prem physical, or virtual based environments? Are any of the processes different, any of the tooling, or any of the procedures different? Eric, do you want to?
No, they're really not today. I mean, there are some additional technologies that you may choose to adopt, for example, NRDR strategies, but our current plans around our VM platform migration for our application tier, we're not changing anything.
So the one thing I would say you need to keep in mind from a process perspective that's maybe a little unique from a virtualized environment on-premise is that something is that a lot of times you may not actually own that underlying host technology. You may just be dealing with a virtual machine. So one thing you need to make sure is don't have all your virtual machines running on the same host, because if that host goes offline, then everything goes online. So that is actually a little bit of a distinction that I think you do need to keep in mind between a physical environment and a virtualized environment. And then when you go and talk about Azure, that case, Microsoft is going to kind of take care of the underlying host level, so you don't really have control necessarily of where the VMs are. But there's something called availability sets that's very important for you to go and set up your SP environment using those, so that way when maintenance activity is going on from an Azure perspective, it minimizes the downtime for your application. And if you look at the Azure SLAs in general, they basically assume that you don't have a single point of failure in there. You really need to be using availability sets to be able to actually achieve the 99.9 something, depending on what the service is.
Okay, great. So there are some differences.
Not from a process perspective.
Processes are the same, but you know, virtualized servers, be careful about all sitting on the same host, and then for Azure, use the availability sets.
But in principle, the operating system maintenance of the guest operating system still needs to take care.
Yep.
That's where these processes that we're talking about are coming into the game again.
Okay, right. There's a question specific to an SAP upgrade. So we talked about OS upgrades, we talked about SQL upgrades. What if you do an SAP upgrade on the SAP application level? Or I know, for example, we do big SAP releases. Can you use the processes there as well? Who wants to take
that? I can take that. So sadly, we cannot do completely downtime minimized. That would be a near zero downtime project from SAP. As mentioned beforehand already, SAP changes. Those are a little bit different kind of piece. What we can do is we can minimize risk with doing SAP upgrades, any kind of major change rollout. And this goes especially easy when you have two database servers like we have with our always-on configuration, local high availability, where before we actually start to roll out any change into production, we freeze data movement between the two database servers. That means we keep the secondary database server on the level that production had before the downtime started. Then we apply the changes to the active database server. So the changes are being applied, everything goes there. And if we get a go, we just resume the data movement again, and then the second database server catches up with all the changes, we'll synchronize, and off we go with high availability again. If in case, which happens very rarely, but in the 16 years, no, close to 20 years that we've had SAP, we actually had to do it once. We had to roll back because something happened during support pack upgrades and couldn't be fixed. Then this really has a huge benefit because in the normal scenario, you now would have to restore the backup that you took from production before the downtime into your only available database. In our case, since we have two databases and we kept the version right there on disk from before the change, we, in difference, just throw away the database that was upgraded, point SAP to the database that still has the earlier version, open up the SAP, off we go, and now we can restore the other database server from a new backup that we take here and go back. And so that's really risk minimization because I don't have to mark with my only production database with a backup that I've never tested and don't know if it works. I have a database already here that I know it's workable, and I can take a backup, I can restore. If something would go bad during that restore, I can do it over and over again. I still have my production database up and running ready. So that's the big benefit of minimizing risk there.
So what I heard you say, the big benefit was, If something goes wrong,
yes,
assuming worst case, your secondary that you left in the state of before the upgrade,
mm-hmm,
you just switch to that, you throw away your primary,
correct,
and restore that later from a backup.
Yep.
So your actual unplanned downtime because of this, you know, failed upgrade would be a few minutes versus whatever it would be to restore your backup.
Yep.
If you have to have, you know, if you have to restore your backup for your single database, that would be hours. I think the only drawback really is that you're running for a brief moment without redundancy.
Correct.
Is there any,
correct,
other drawbacks?
No.
Okay.
But that's the problem, or that's the risk with all these procedures. So you have a time period of elevated risk where, depending on what kind of work you do on the other server, you cannot fail over doing that. But nowadays, really, the hardware and everything is so stable that unplanned downtime really occurs so rarely that I don't really see it as a high risk.
So we do this process, obviously, for OS and SQL upgrades. We just talked about SAP releases. How about major SAP upgrades, like a new enhancement pack or...
Same thing. And by the way, just talking about hardware stability, I would use exactly that process to actually also get rid of the Lemon server in case I ended up with a Lemon server to get it out of the environment as quickly as possible.
Okay, so what you're saying, Lemon server, like any kind of
a server that gives me nothing but trouble.
Gives you problems or throws a lot of alerts, you would quickly replace that with basically
using this process.
Bringing up your redundant server Okay. There's some follow-up questions, and there's a lot of them, so we'll have to see if we can cover them all. One of the items is, are there any SAP technologies that are not covered by this process?
Out of the box, yes. I would say something like T-Rex. But then with T-Rex, you can set up a little bit of different setup to actually get that secured. Eric.
Yeah, some of the additional bolt-on technologies have their own availability design where they do their own self-replication management, for instance, between nodes for a primary and slave. In other cases, you can use Windows Failover clustering, but sometimes it's not supported.
Yeah, so T-Rex is one of those cases.
Yeah.
Where it's, once again, a process that we set up over three servers, so we can still go ahead and do our procedure, but it looks a little bit different. But the principles are the same.
What about live cache?
Live cache is clustered, so we have a cluster capability.
Okay, great. So I heard the only thing really is T-Rex and maybe some third-party bolt-ons or other systems, and then hopefully they would have their own high availability design. Okay. There's another question. So if we don't have any of this in place today, I assume this is a customer that's just running on a non-redundant system, what's the first thing to start with? Are there any kind of priorities? You know, and I assume that means would you start with the database or would you start with changing your installation or how would you go after doing that?
Aaron. So, I mean, if you're starting from nothing, absolutely nothing, or I guess maybe if you have something. I think there's really some important foundational items. Some other folks maybe can chime in with some other ideas, but for me, what's really important is that foundational items, such as having your backups in place, using the alias names, getting those in. You can get those in as maybe you're going and setting up your cluster or switching to always on or something along those lines. But those foundational items is going to make everything else so much easier. And then in terms on where you would actually do the high availability itself, I really have depends on your business process and your business criticality. You may be able to survive not going with always on for your database layer, but maybe you need more app servers or so on and so forth. So it really, really depends on your business.
Yeah. And think about with the database server, you have multiple options. You can run it as a single server, no real high availability. You can cluster it, that at least gives you a server level high availability. But if the SAN storage has an issue, you still are going to be down. And then the third one is SQL Server Always On, where you have two independent storage areas, which gives you the highest flexibility and the highest security. But all of them have different amounts of money they cost to implement. And so therefore, it's depending on the business impact and the criticality that it has for your business.
Okay. Looking at a lot of support cases, or looking back for nearly 20 years and a lot of support cases, from my point of view, coming out of the database business, it usually is the database that I would be mostly concerned, because that thing contains your business data. That contains the single truth very often about your company's financial status. Having that data available at any point in time is a very important factor here. You can have many service application servers that would be very willing, that are healthy, that would be very, very willing to work if there would be a database that they can work against. So that's what we are seeing usually, that it all circles around the availability of the database and really a current image of that database. And that's where I would start to really put measures in place to have the database available. On top of that, then really have the SAP system itself, the application layer with the single points of failures available in these kind of things.
And then that's a very valid point that Jürgen is saying. The SAP application layer, whether it's the central services instance or the application layer, that can be rebuilt if needed from scratch. You get the installation CDs, you can do a rebuild. That there's nothing that you really need to keep for a long time other than your instance profiles, and those are stored in the database. All your business data is in the database, so that's really the one thing you really have to have secure to make sure that if something happens, you always can restore it, can go back to.
Okay, great. There's a quick follow-up question. I think we have time for one more. What about mixing different environments from an OS level? So, for example, can you run SQL databases with Unix application servers? Would that still work, or what are the limitations there?
At the moment, when we look at SAP, it depends certainly on the database that you're using. There are situations where customers run exotic databases like AS400 or S390 when they use a Windows application. When we look at SQL Server, that is what our product is. There is no, at the moment, you need to be homogeneous in terms of operating system. Homogeneous in the sense that you have to have Windows on the application layer as well as on the database layer. It might be different Windows releases, so we can envision a situation where we had situations in the past where customers were running a more recent operating system on the database side and hung one version back on the application side. That is all possible. Mixing Linux and Windows, for example, on the different layers, as mentioned, very dependent on the database that's being used.
Okay. Thank you, Jürgen. I think we're out of time. I want to make sure that you see that the Microsoft IT Showcase has lots of topics, not just SAP and high availability there on the Microsoft platform. So you see here, there's a link, microsoft.com/IT Showcase. We also want to get lots of feedback from you. If you have any kind of questions, please send them to showcase@microsoft.com. And please provide us your feedback. Did you think that panel was useful? Would you like to see something different? Let us know and we'll make that happen. So with that, thank you very much. And thanks to Elke, Aaron, Jürgen, and Eric, our presenters, our panelists, for answering all those questions. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.